Up next, we have our book reading program, Ohomani Iyotaka, read by Gail Hubling.
The Long Knives Are Crying, a novel by Joseph M. Marshall III. Chapter 15. The Colonel. A cool morning breeze slid in from the east as Captains Frederick Benteen and Miles Keel stood at the west edge of the parade ground at Fort Abraham Lincoln, the outpost along the western banks of the Missouri River. The brown waters of the river were roiling high with spring melt runoff. Both men were slender and less than 6 feet tall, thus filling the requirements for cavalry soldiers. The officers were watching a column of nearly 20 mounted troopers practice turning left into line. They were also keeping an eye on the lithe figure standing 20 yards to their left. He, too, was watching the troopers' drill. That man had his arms crossed and observed the efforts of the mounted squad with a hard, narrow-eyed gaze. "Seems to be the general is not entirely pleased with our newest recruits," Benteen commented in a low voice. Keogh chuckled wryly. "I know for a fact that half of those men hardly ever rode a horse before they signed up at Jefferson's Barracks," he said in a slight Irish brogue. "Perhaps we would be wiser to teach them to dismount quickly without tripping over themselves. Like the Crow, the Sioux put their boys on horses before they can walk." "Well, I myself am a bit more concerned that they know which end of the Springfield rifle is which," sighed Benteen. "If we cannot hope to match the Sioux as mounted fighters, then we are forced to rely on firepower. Given, of course, that we can provide sufficient ammunition for them to practice with." The man upped the line and crossed his arms and approached briskly. "Gentlemen," he said in a clipped tone, stopping 3 yards away. Even at that distance, he had to look up at Benteen and Keogh. He had a thin face with a long nose and a sandy mustache, the same color as his shoulder-length hair. There was even more authority in his smoky blue eyes than in his voice, which was dripping with it. And although it was cool morning, he wore no uniform coat. "Sir," they replied in unison. "Tell me, what do you think of the newest members of the 7th, Lieutenant Colonel George Armstrong Custer?" "Tell me what you think of the newest members of the 7th. Lieutenant Colonel George Armstrong Custer tilted his head toward the drilling soldiers. "General Terry has assigned them to us. I am certain that after a few days under the capable guidance of the Sergeant Major, we should have adequate troops on our hands, General," Benteen replied. Custer had held the brevet rank of Major General during the Civil War, and it was customary to address an officer by the highest grade he had held. Custer nodded, keeping a relentless stare fixed on the two troop commanders. "Adequate, perhaps," he replied, "but they are nonetheless still recruits. We are soon to take to the field, and our assignment will require experienced soldiers. Owing to that, I will distribute them throughout each troop. After the Sergeant Major is through with them, it will be up to your men to bring them further into line." "Yes, sir," Keogh replied. "How soon are we to depart?" "In 2 or 3 weeks, I suspect," Custer said, taking a quick glance over his shoulder as the recruits reached the south end of the parade ground and executed a sloppy turn. "That should be sufficient time for you to turn these men into basic soldiers. There should be no more than 3 new men in each troop." "We will do what we can, General," Benteen assured Custer. "You will do what you must, Captain. What I expect from you," Custer insisted. "We cannot afford to take an ill-prepared command into the field." "Yes, sir. Is it true then, General? Are we to go west toward the Yellowstone region?" "That is certain." "I trust that Washington City was as grandiose as I hear it is," Captain Keogh ventured, alluding to the fact that Custer had only just returned from the east. Rumors swirled around that trip that Custer had stepped on one too many toes with his accusations of fraud in the Indian Bureau. "To be known as the Yellowstone Expedition," Custer went on, ignoring Keogh's comment about the capital. "We are to convince the recalcitrant Sioux to accept reality and report to the agencies," Custer smiled thinly. Hurried footfalls reached them. It was a sergeant from the office of the commanding general, Alfred E. Terry. He stopped in front of them and saluted Custer smartly. "Sir, the general sent me to find you. He wishes to speak with you immediately." Custer nodded nonchalantly. "Of course, Sergeant. I was on the way to my quarters. After that, I will speak with the general." A warning look filled the sergeant's eyes, but no words came out to match it. "Very well, sir. I shall tell the general." Custer turned his attention back to Benteen and Keel. I shall send an orderly around to remind you, of course, but I will have officers call this afternoon. I am certain that the general will give us our orders, and I want the 7th to be prepared to take to the field. Spinning on his heel and without so much as a glance in any direction, Custer turned and walked toward a frame house with a porch. Keel turned his attention back to the mounted troopers, noting Benteen's cold stare in Custer's direction. In my estimation, Keel said, pointing at the mounted recruits, a long ride would do them more good than learning formation drills. Most of them simply need to learn to stay in the saddle first. We should instruct the sergeant major to do just that. Agreed, Benteen replied, only mildly interested. Keel reached into a coat pocket for the carefully trimmed portion of a cigar he had left there and put it between his lips. I think I shall have a word with the sergeant major, he muttered. Perhaps I will take those troopers out for an excursion before the general has officers call. Benteen nodded absently as Keel strode across the parade ground toward the mounted soldiers. From across the yard came the sergeant major's strident, exasperated yells. Unmindful of anything transpiring outside his own parlor, Custer took his uniform coat from his wife, Elizabeth. As he slipped it on, she watched him with a critical gaze. Dispatches have come from the east, she told him. Yes. As you know, Libby, there is a campaign in the making. I will convince General Terry to let the 7th take the lead as well. We should. She sighed and crossed her arms. I believe Alfred is a good man. He realizes the worth of the 7th. However, do be cautious, Audie. Let him speak first. A frown creased his forehead, drawing his heavy brows together. Well, whatever do you mean, dear? He is the commanding officer here. I simply think you should be more mindful of that. Hold your ambitions close to your vest. A sharp growl and then a screech from the basement interrupted the colonel before he could reply. Audie, I do wish you would set that poor creature free. He does so torment Abigail each time she has to go past him to the cool room. An impish smile spread across his face. Dear, he is restrained by a stout chain. He cannot hurt her. She is convinced otherwise, and I do not see what you value in a scrawny old bobcat. I assure you, dear, he will harm no one. Adjusting his coat a final time, the colonel paused at the door to put on his hat. With a wave, he was gone. 10 minutes later, Lieutenant Colonel Custer took a step back and lowered himself slowly into the nearest chair, his face paler by a shade. Sir, he said in a near whisper, his eyes uncharacteristically downcast, I do not understand why I am being punished for answering questions put to me by a committee. Major General Alfred E. Terry pointed to a pile of pages on the desk before him. According to this, Armstrong, you did much more than simply answer questions. Of all things, you accused the President's brother of being a thief. I testified as to what I know to be fact, sir. These dispatches arrived here before you did, before you came back from Washington. I am being directed to take you off the duty list, to strip you of your command, Armstrong. The general shoved his chair back and stepped to the window, looking out toward the river for a moment before he turned and redirected a glare at the other man in the room. I was hoping that you would come of your own accord and inform me as to what happened back there. Or did you think that the hornet's nest you stirred up would not reach this far? Custer's shoulders slumped. General, I took it upon myself to try to set the record straight. I waited for several hours for the president to see me. He would not. He ignored me. Do you blame him? No, sir, I suppose not. You suppose not? Do you realize, Armstrong, that for all intents and purposes, you called into question the integrity of the President of the United States? To make it worse, the press decided it was worthwhile news. If Grant wanted to make you the commanding officer at a fort in the Florida Keys or of an anthill in Arizona, he could. The only way you could deter that would be to resign from the Army. I wrote a note, General, apologizing. I tried to see General Sherman, but he ignored me as well. You wrote a note? Did you not stop to think that nothing less than a heartfelt personal apology would do? What were you thinking, Armstrong? There is little I can do for you in this instant. Do you not realize that? What am I to do, Alfred? All I know is soldiering. Terry threw up his hand and sat back down. Perhaps you should have considered that before you opened your mouth. Custer sighed deeply. Will you not speak on my behalf, sir? Yes, of course. I will do what I can, but in the meantime, I have orders to follow. You are relieved, Colonel. Major Reno will assume command of the regiment. Custer came out of his chair. Major Reno? Despite the outburst, Terry gazed calmly at Custer. Armstrong, unless you want me to follow these orders to the letter, which would mean you would never hold another command in the field, I suggest you aspire to a bit of humility. I know that is difficult for you, but I do not wish to take a stand on your behalf and then realize it was the wrong thing to do. Do I make myself clear, Colonel? Perfectly, sir. I cannot abide that my regiment will take to the field and I not be along to share in the dangers. I will do my best, sir. Then I suggest you send a telegram to Sherman. Humble yourself, Armstrong. Oblivious to the usual daily activity in and around the outpost, Custer walked slowly across the parade ground. If he had hoped that the anonymity of an isolated frontier post on the edge of Indian country would soften Grant's angst, he was wrong. Who would have thought that Fort Abraham Lincoln would be a cornerstone of a campaign against the Sioux? That was clearly Phil Sheridan's idea, and therein was a ray of hope. General William Sherman knew how valuable the 7th would be, as valuable as the point was to the spear. He stopped in his tracks. Perhaps he should point that out to Terry. But he forced himself not to turn around. Instead, with a resigned sigh, he headed for his house. Aspire to a bit of humility, the general had advised. So he would take that advice. Libby was waiting with a pot of tea and patient silence. Hanging up his hat, he took a seat at the writing desk in the front room. You knew, I think, he said to her gently. You knew what was going to happen. Just remember, Audie, that I, too, am in the army. Therefore, I know how it works. What am I to do? Follow orders like the good soldier you are. The general will put in a word on your behalf. There will be talk, but you must rise above it. Let Benteen and Reno think what they will. We must be patient, dear. We must be patient. Amid the clank of china and silverware and the low buzz of conversation in the officers' mess that evening, Benteen grinned across the table. Congratulations on your new command, he said to Major Marcus Reno, a man with dark eyes and a thick, dark mustache. The major, a small, nervous man, smiled tentatively. If I would have earned it on my own merits, I would be pleased, he replied. Winning anything by default is not always a good thing. Benteen leaned closer. Nevertheless, Major, were I you, I would make the most of it. Reno allowed himself a smile. Of that you can be sure, Frederick. We are to head west toward the Yellowstone, Benteen went on, in a matter of weeks, perhaps days. Take a strong hand, Marcus. Make this regiment your own. Earn it, if you must, by putting your stamp on it. A firm but fair hand and success in the field will make General Terry take notice. What you say is true, Frederick, but our erstwhile colonel seems to live under a lucky star. He always manages to land on his feet. The turbulent career of Custer had been the topic of conversation and speculation on many occasions by the officers of the 7th Cavalry. The exceptions were Captain Thomas Weir and Tom Custer, and Lieutenant W. W. Cook. One was a staunch ally of the Mercurial Colonel, one was his brother, and the third was the aide-de-camp. The three of them sat at a table apart from Reno and Benteen, trying to catch bits and pieces of their conversation. Benteen nodded towards Weir and the young Custer. You must be especially firm with those two gentlemen, Marcus. You must watch your back around them. Replace Cook with your old man quickly. Reno nodded. I appreciate your advice, Frederick. However, I think I would sooner face the Sioux than deal with those three. I have a feeling, Marcus, we will have no choice on both of those matters. And that concludes Chapter 15.
This program is made possible by funding from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.